Good afternoon. This is the First District of the Illinois Appellate Court, First Division. My name is Terry Lavin, and I'll be presiding today, along with my colleagues, Justice Aurelia Puchinski and Justice Michael Hyman. We're looking for maybe 20 minutes apiece, save some time for rebuttal if you're the appellant. And if you're ready to proceed, please go ahead.
Before we do, just to clarify, did I hear from the clerk that Mr. Anderson is on?
Yes.
Great.
Okay. Please proceed, counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Deborah Lovey from the Exoneration Project on behalf of the appellant George Anderson. And before I begin, I'd like to let the court know I appreciate the writ allowing Mr. Anderson to be here with us this afternoon. It has been an honor to represent him. Mr. Anderson is a lovely man who has patiently waited since the early 1990s for someone to hear his outcry about the torture that induced the key inculpatory evidence against him in two unrelated murder cases. Mr. Anderson's outcry in the early 1990s almost sounded too horrible to be true. But we now know that the very specific and idiosyncratic methods that he was describing torture were routine among the underlings of former Commander John Burge.
We've read the briefs. A lot to read here, a lot of briefs and a lot of interesting reading. My first question is a little bit in your reply, but in your opening brief, you didn't talk about the standard review and the state did. Do you agree with the state's analysis of the standard review that we use throughout this case?
No, Your Honor, and we did discuss the standard review. What our contention is that a legal error was committed, that the lower court was tasked with an objective test.
I'm not asking whether there's error. I know you say there. What's the standard of review? I'm talking about the standard review.
Exactly. So because there was a legal error, this court should conduct a de novo review.
De novo review.
Of that mistake. Absolutely. Although, as we do in the briefs, I contend that we win under any of the standards, but there was a legal mistake at the outset that this court made. It just applied the wrong test and in doing so, neglected to conduct the objective test that was required of it. And in that case, there is when this court is clear, when there's a legal error like that, there is a de novo review.
Was that mistake made in the first order by Judge Hooks or the second order?
I'm sorry,
in terms of the standard of review and the burdens, you indicated that the judge made a mistake, right?
Correct.
Applied the wrong standard. My question is, there were two orders entered by the trial court here, one on January 6, 2020, and the other 2.5 months later on March 16, 2020. Is that correct?
I'm assuming you have the dates correct. But yes, there were two orders that were entered in the second order, which is the one that's governing below.
Why was there a second order entered?
We had filed a petition for rehearing and the judge clarified a few things.
Okay. Well, clarified, he took a lot out. And did some of the stuff that he take out apply to the argument that you're making in terms of the standard of the burden of proof and standard of review?
No, my arguments are addressing the most recent order, the governing order, the second order. The amended one.
I understand that. And the reason why the court would have jurisdiction to cover that is because you filed a motion to reconsider or rehear or.
There was an amended notice of appeal that then occurred to cover both. And nobody has contested the jurisdiction at this point.
Jurisdiction is something we have to consider, as you know.
Absolutely.
You're no rookie here.
absolutely.
My question is, what happened between 1-6 and 3-16 for the court to come out with a second order? What prompted it?
I cross my cases. I don't recall. I assume a petition for rehearing, but I don't recall for sure. What I do know and can tell you is we filed an amended notice of appeal to make sure that there were no jurisdictional problems.
Well, no, I saw the amended. I saw that too, but what I didn't see was what would be in between. I didn't see any petition for rehearing. And again, this is a voluminous record, but.
It is a voluminous record. I don't recall there being one. I could very quickly look at my jurisdictional statement, which would. Yes, no, it does not appear that there was one.
Yeah, okay. All right, go ahead.
Let me ask the next question. So
please.
There's a lot here that you say, and there's a lot that you say the judge did wrong. Okay. Some of this is more telling than others as far as our reversing. What would you say are your major argument? I mean, the one that is a sure grand slam, and there may be more than one, I understand, but let's not say they're all grand slam, but give us the ones that you think are definitely, you know, the others may be three basers, two basers, okay, but what are the best ones?
I hear you. Well, the grand slam, in my opinion, is that the court applied the wrong standard. And when you apply the correct standard, the objective test, whether or not the outcome of the suppression hearing would likely have been different back then, if the officers who denied harming Mr. Anderson had been subject to the impeachment evidence based on the pattern and practice evidence, I think that once you take that to the objective level, there can be no question that we would prevail. Objectively speaking, the outcome could likely would have been different. And this is evidence that has been credited in case after case, in Jakes, in Plummer, in Claiborne Smith, in Tyler. These are detectives who all worked under Burge at the time of the interrogations. They had, you know, Kill could have been impeached with 40 claims of abuse. Halloran and O'Brien had 50 claims apiece. All of them have invoked the Fifth Amendment at one time or another. And what Judge Hooks did was he looked at whether or not he personally believed that these notorious Burge proteges were abusive, but didn't ask the correct question of the probabilistic question of what likely would have happened if at the time of the suppression hearing, Mr. Anderson could have presented this evidence. And had that question been asked, the way the suppression hearing is structured, Mr. Anderson would have presented a prima facie case, I've been abused, and then the state carried the burden of proof after that, at which point they had to prove that the abuse did not happen. And they would, all of the detectives would have been impeached with this mountain of evidence that showed that they had an abusive tendency and that they could not be trusted. And as for your question, Justice Hyman, about the slam dunk, the detectives never even denied the violation of the right to counsel. Mr. Anderson made a prima facie case that he was denied his right to counsel, that he asked detectives Kill, O'Brien, and Stelick for a lawyer. The only one who ever denied this one was Detective Halloran. The state carried the burden of proof. It shifted from once that first case was made, the state carried the burden of proof. Detective Kill never made that denial. He never said that he didn't. And you have all this evidence that that was sort of his modus operandi. He was not giving people the right to counsel. He was not honoring that right. And he is now deceased. So the state will never be able to meet that burden of proof. They had the opportunity to do so, and they failed. They did not ask Kill to, he never denied it. They never asked him, and it was their burden. And so there's another slam dunk for you as to how, you know, this suppression hearing, when you go back and look what would have happened if we had all of this evidence against these detectives back when that suppression hearing happened, there's no question that Mr. Anderson would have prevailed.
Okay, and what you're asking us to do is to vacate the conviction and send the case back for a new trial and have this evidence barred, correct?
Yes, we are asking to vacate the conviction, send it back. The court can take the additional step of barring this evidence, or the court, you know, the Torture Act gives the court wide discretion. Under Section 50A, it talks about an appropriate order.
But the last thing you need is another suppression hearing, right?
Agreed. And because we have unquestionably won on the violation of right to counsel, if nothing else, because, you know, I posit that we won on all of it, but that one's, you know, a nice, clean, easy one. I would suggest that the appropriate remedy is to vacate the conviction and suppress the statement. But at bare minimum, the conviction needs to be vacated. It needs to go back to square one. That's what this court did in Gibson. They vacated and ordered a new trial and a new judge. And Jackie Wilson, the conviction was vacated. It was remanded for a new trial. In Anthony Jakes, which was consolidated with this case, the conviction was vacated. The charges were nullified. So you could see all sorts of different things might happen upon that remand. But at the bare minimum, the conviction should be vacated and the statement should be suppressed.
Okay, that's all the questions I have. Anything else from my colleagues?
Yes. Question with regard to the judge declining to make adverse inferences against the detectives. That's a discretionary call. And what's your response to, I don't think you, I'm not sure you responded to that or not in your reply brief.
And again, Justice Simon, this is the difference between the objective and the subjective. So what the judge did was he said, when I'm looking at these detectives, I'm going to categorically refuse to accept any allegation where the officer denied the conduct. So Kill says I didn't do it, that's good enough for me. But if you're looking at what likely would have happened at the original trial, that's an objective test. And the judge and the judge below did not do that. Judge Hooks also categorically refused to credit any evidence where the officer wasn't asked, where there was evidence that said this officer abused me and the officer neither admitted nor denied it. Judge Hooks eliminated all that from it. He eliminated categorically all evidence where the OPS didn't substantiate it. And we know now that at that time, OPS wasn't substantiating any allegation. And he can categorically refuse to draw any inference from the Fifth Amendment invocations. So Judge Hooks personally decided, I'm just not going to believe evidence if the detective denied it or if he didn't deny it, but he didn't admit it. But that was not the objective test. And that's why there's no deference owed to those sorts of decisions. What he was supposed to ask is, if there had been a suppression hearing, could this likely have changed the outcome? And when you ask that proper question, the answer is unquestionably yes. I mean, this was such on-point pattern evidence, because what happened here was at the height of the Burge crisis. Burge was still commanding when these interrogations happened. So you have evidence like Ivan Smith, who is abused by the same officers, and he gives the same very idiosyncratic description of a phone book and a blunt object and a torso beating, months after what happened to Mr. Anderson. And he testified after Mr. Anderson. I mean, that's one heck of a coincidence. Now, Judge Hooks decided, I'm just not going to believe it. But that wasn't the question. It wasn't supposed to be, do I personally, in my heart of hearts, think Ivan Smith is telling the is lying to me and that this is just a very odd coincidence. The question is, would this have likely changed the outcome? And that's why it keeps coming back to this, using the wrong standard is really what is the heart of the wrong ruling. So you have evidence, Ivan Smith, Jesse Clement, and Cortez Brown were also both beaten with blunt objects by O'Brien close in time. You have Anthony Jakes, who presented evidence in this same hearing about Kill and Boudreau abusing him just weeks later, Johnny Plummer. So you have all this evidence that many, many, many courts have credited. And the fact that Judge Hooks personally didn't believe it is not what governs here. And it's not owed deference because he was using the wrong method of adjudication.
The other question is section 5 of the response is the one you didn't respond to. That had to do with the evidence of the doctor. Dr. Kudecki. I didn't see any response to that in your reply.
There was a brief response, but I mostly relied on the briefs. Now, as the court knows, we don't have to prove medical proof of the injury, but Dr. Kudecki was the treating doctor who went in, who did the UPJ surgery, and who said that the scarring was consistent with the torture. So you have medical evidence that, and Judge Hooks decided that it was too attenuated. And, there were questions back in the early 90s about, how far to push these sorts of abuse allegations. They almost seemed too wild to believe. And I think litigation strategies were made based on that because it was just such egregious stuff. But that's why the Torture Act is so important, because we know things differently now. And certainly if, the court chose to remand without suppressing the statement, and the state wanted to introduce the statement and there was a new suppression hearing, that medical evidence would be presented. And I think it would play out very differently now when you have all the evidence that these detectives were routinely using the telephone book, the blunt object, beating the torso, and that Mr. Anderson suffered in a way that it was consistent timing-wise and scar tissue-wise and only on the left side where he was beaten-wise, that strongly suggests the medical evidence supports what he is saying happened to him. It's not evidence he needs to have. And this was, we were very conscious of space in the reply brief. We came in just, squeaked right by there, which is why we chose to rely primarily on the opening brief. But it is strong evidence yet again that this suppression hearing would have looked, very different if we had known what we know now about these abusive detectives.
My last question has to do with, you mentioned how your client has been waiting a long time, and has been a long time. But things began to happen in the 2000s, and here we are, just past 2022 into 2023, and this is one of the early, with at the heytime of this Burge's evilness. Why is it taking so long in this case? What would you, whoever is, a lot of people to blame or the system, or how would you characterize why we are doing this now, as opposed to some years ago, as with some of the other people that you discussed?
It is one of the tragedies of the system, Justice Hyman. I know that Mr. Anderson has simultaneously been litigating a post-conviction petition, the Torture Act. Some of these claims take a long time. I'm appellate counsel. I know I certainly met my deadlines as quickly as I could. And,
I'm not saying to you, but what is it about this? No, but I mean, there's something in the system is what you're saying. Why is that? I mean, this is one of the most important things with regard to how our government operates, right? When somebody is abused and tortured, and that this should take this long. I'm just trying to find out why this happened. I mean, you say it happens. Okay, what you've done?
I wholeheartedly agree. It's tragic. I wish I could say he's my only Burge era appellate client. He's not. These cases take a long time to wind through the system, and that's one of the tragedies, is that you have people like Mr. Anderson, like I said, is a lovely man. I'm glad that he's been able to be here listening to us. He's been waiting a long, long time for justice, and I hope the court can expeditiously offer him that.
Okay, let's hear from the state.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. As I said before, Andrew Levine on behalf of the state. I guess I just make a couple preliminary remarks and, of course, address any questions you have or in a few points that were just made by counsel. What's permeating the brief, first of all, with respect to standard review, it's not de novo. We've said it extensively in our brief, and I think this is a manifestly erroneous standard with respect to Judge Hooks's determinations. His determinations in this case...
It wouldn't be manifest if it's an error.
Well, they're factual and credible. I think this goes to the heart of what they're arguing between the subjective and the objective. And I believe it would be a manifestly erroneous standard with respect to Judge Hooks's determinations as to the credibility or his conclusions regarding certain facts in the case before him. And I think their argument basically, I think there's two main points that they're making. One, the objective-subjective issue, which I think stems primarily from Wuerl. And I'll get to that in a moment. And then I think the second point has to do with the pattern and practice and his conclusions about the admissibility or inadmissibility of some of those. Let me start with the Wuerl part. Wuerl, I think, is easy on its face to distinguish between the case here and what happened there. I don't think there can be much doubt that Judge Hooks, first of all, Judge Hook is very well versed and very well aware of the history of the Chicago Police Department. He's very well aware of torture claims. He's very aware of the coercion.
He had all the problems case.
He had the Wilson case in this court, of
so
course.
Did we.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I said, so did we.
Absolutely. And I think that when this court recognizes that he applied the standard of law properly in Wilson, recognized was it what it was, and followed the law, and I believe in this case he did the identical thing. In Wuerl, however, as a distinguishing point, the judge misunderstood the role of the hearing. In fact, this court quoted Judge Alonzo, where he said, Pienta, in fact, tortured Mr. Wuerl and coerced his confession, and that was the inquiry. That's not the inquiry. It's whether or not the outcome of a new suppression hearing would likely be different if the officers were subjected to impeachment with the newly discovered evidence. Judge Hooks clearly understood what the proper standard was, and he applied that here.
Why do you say he clearly understood it? I know he says it early on, but he seemed to restate later on how he was deciding the case, and it was not that standard.
Well, I think what Judge Hooks did was he decided that under that standard that they were not likely to, I think recognizing the severity and the remedial nature of the Turk proceeding, especially with respect to Christian and the other cases that define the burden shifting and the proceedings in a Turk hearing, I think he did determine that there was not a likelihood that the outcome would be different. However, given the strength of the case, he also found that there was, in fact, voluntariness of it. So he went that extra step. However, I don't believe he needed to, because I believe he found initially that they didn't sustain the burden and show that it would likely be an altered outcome on rehearing. But nonetheless, he did go that extra step, acknowledged that, and he found that there was no coercion. But the other point with respect to Wuerl, Your Honor, is that, you know, in Wuerl, you had Pienta, who got on the stand and took the fifth, and you had the state agreeing that if five or six other officers, I believe it was, were called to the stand, they would also invoke the fifth. So here, markedly different than that, every single officer got up on the stand, was subjected to cross-examination. Judge Hooks heard it. They were subjected to cross-examination with the same allegations that the petitioner in this case bears the burden on in order to demonstrate that a new outcome would be likely. Judge Hooks essentially had a suppression hearing without it being labeled as a suppression hearing. He went through that analysis and ultimately did decide that it was voluntary.
So you admit that this is akin to a suppression hearing?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You admit that this was akin, you know, similar to suppression. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor, I absolutely do admit that. I don't believe that he needed to get there, because I think the initial burden.
But he did get there.
Absolutely, Your Honor, that's exactly what I believe. And I believe that they were afforded the opportunity, Judge Hooks was, to assess the strength. So not only did he make a decision that it wasn't likely to alter the outcome, he heard it anyway and made that decision. And I think that's important. But the other critical point of distinction from Wuerl, which I think goes to the heart of this objective and subjective, is the consistency of the testimony in Wuerl by Mr. Wuerl and his brother, I believe it was, who testified, and the state actually agreed that the brother was a credible witness in that case. Wuerl never changed his story. In this particular case, you've got Anderson testifying under oath, and this goes to the judicial admissions, and I think they conflate that with the judicial waiver argument, but you have Anderson testifying under oath at his motion to suppress, that Boudreau never struck him and never injured him, and these are, of course, made in detail in the briefs, but you also have him testifying at the trial, at the Miggins trial, that he was treated well, and in this case, they tried to call their former PD, who now Judge O'Hara, who got up on the stand. He didn't corroborate the explanation that they're trying to give you, trying to avoid the outcome and the effect of a judicial admission. Those are judicial admissions, and if there's a judicial admission, you're a stop.
But give me one case. And you don't cite any that has a judicial admission in a criminal case.
Well, Judge, what I would say is that Christian recognized that this is a civil proceeding. So if Christian recognizes that a Turk proceeding is a civil proceeding, then certainly the rules of
No. But you can't have it both ways. I mean, I think, you know, that to me is having it both ways, because you're taking a criminal case. It's in the criminal dimension that you're using it as a judicial admission. You know, it's not a civil case, and there is no case, no criminal case cited by the judge, and there's no criminal case cited by you. And I want to just take a 1 second to say you do cite a criminal case, but if the case was a Rule 23 case,
right?
And you do know that you're not allowed to cite Rule 23s before 2021. Do you understand that?
I do understand that, Judge. And your
brief, that you did it, but the brief has at least three instances of violations of the Supreme Court rules, that the state has violated the rules. You understand that too?
I do, Your Honor. And that was an error. And I actually have another issue with the brief that we submitted that I was going to actually.
Okay. I appreciate that. So, but going back to the point is all the cases are civil cases, the ones that you cite and the ones the judge cites. And there is not one criminal case that's out there. So I think that says a lot about your argument.
Well, I think it says something about the argument, but it doesn't give you a basis to overturn Judge Hook's ruling, because whether Your Honor were to determine that he was stopped from making bound by a judicial admission or not, Judge Hook still heard the testimony and still, given the perceived the posture of the case, had to decide the credibility. So Judge Hook's would be entitled to a manifestly erroneous standard with respect to his findings of a lack of credibility. I mean,
so you think that our order, one way or the other, it has to be based on the manifest weight of the evidence. In order to reverse it, let's say, it would have to be that his findings were against the manifest weight of the evidence, right?
I do, Judge.
Okay.
I do, Justice. Yes, I absolutely do. So I think there's the multiple points of distinction with respect to Worrell, and specifically there you had a consistency. Here you have a total a lack of consistency factually with respect to the testimony, which brings the credibility decision in right front and center in front of Judge Hooks. The second point, I guess, would be the main point, and there is a lot.
Going back to Worrell.
Sure.
Isn't it exactly like Worrell that the judge did decide the ultimate issue of whether the confession was coerced or not? Isn't that exactly what the judge did? And that's what Worrell says you can't do.
Yes, Judge, I agree with you that he decided the ultimate issue, but the way that Judge Hooks did not look at this case through the lens that Judge Alonzo looked at, viewed Worrell. And I think Judge Hooks was very well aware of this court's rulings in Worrell and the subsequent cases, Wilson, in terms of procedurally how you need to go through this. And I believe that Judge Hooks clearly determined that they were not likely to alter the outcome of a new suppression hearing and could have stopped there. However, I think Judge Hooks, his opinions went so far as to say he viewed George Anderson as jumping on the Burge bus. So I think he went to that length because after deciding that he couldn't sustain his burden, he gave him the benefit of the doubt and went a step further. I think there are a lot of determinations in Judge Hook's opinions which are not necessary for the ruling that he gave us. However, they do not impact it, they don't nullify it, and they're not inconsistent with it. But he absolutely went this next step after deciding they couldn't sustain their burden and said, looked at it and said, you know, I'm gonna look at this and I find that it is voluntary and is not the product of coercion. So I think it's just, although in some sense you can say, well, the same words are there, so isn't that the same as Worrell? But I think it's markedly different because he went through it in 50 pages, a very detailed analysis until he did come up with that conclusion. He absolutely made that finding, but I don't think it's germane to the ultimate ruling or the process, the burden shifting that's supposed to go through in a situation like this.
Counsel, Mr. Anderson was arrested in 1991. Is that correct?
Yes, Judge.
Trial was in 1994 with the motion to suppress filed in 1994. Correct. So from 1991 to 1994, he's telling his attorneys that he was abused. The petitioner's brief says that his attorneys confirm that. And for example, Judge Hook says, oh, he jumped on the torture bandwagon. The torture bandwagon didn't really get any legs until the Egan report in 2006, and certainly wasn't rolling along until the Turk Act. So I don't know what bandwagon he's talking about.
Well, I think he's talking about the allegations against officers specifically that he never claimed abused them. The bandwagon is the subsequent, it's the heart of the case and stuff, the newly discovered evidence. trying to conform your prior testimony, which didn't make any claim against Boudreaux, which sworn testimony in a trial saying that you were treated well, and trying to conform that to events that occur after the fact. So I would interpret that as that, but I guess I don't know exactly. I'm sorry, Your Honor. My apologies.
And that it's sort of a circular argument, because if the confession was coerced,
right,
and if in the trial he was asked to confirm a coerced confession, then so what? The confession was coerced. So you hang somebody from a hook in the wall, and beat them with a rubber hose and a phone book, and then get a coerced confession out of them. And then at trial, you say, isn't it true that you confessed to this? And when you confessed to this, you said, oh, the police didn't torture me, but the confession itself was coerced. So,
well,
what good is that? I mean, I just think it's circular logic.
Well, I don't know if it's circular, because the medical evidence certainly is not new. So when you can't go back now claiming abuse where you have absolute medical, no scientific support for the claims that there was abuse, no supporting records. You have a document, an affidavit filed by Mr. Anderson, found determined by Judge Hooks in his opinion, where the first claim of pain was over a year later. You have a surgery for this UPJ obstruction in March of 1993, yet you have a motion to suppress hearing in January of 1994, where not only is it not mentioned, but his own lawyer got up in the proceeding in front of Judge Hooks and specifically testified that he mentioned to me that any of this supposed injury that he is now saying relates to this happened, I would have sent a subpoena. So he has a total, not only a lack of corroboration by his former lawyer, but I would submit to the court that he has a contradictory evidence by his former lawyer. And as to what Judge Hooks meant, I think it really may have went to the credibility, lack of credibility as well. But I certainly think the lack of scientific support is important. And in fact, here we had this Dr. Krudecki, who was his medical expert. His opinion was that within a reasonable degree of certainty, something was possible. I would have struck in the ask to move to that not even be admissible had I been handling the trial. But for our purposes, I don't think there can be any weight to that. So again, even in this day and age with experts testifying now, you still don't have any corroborative medical evidence. So I think that that's it runs counter to his claim of abuse, and I think that's important as well.
Okay, let's hear from some rebuttal.
Yeah.
Right, I think, I don't know. Are you finished, Mr. Levine?
Oh, yeah, I ran long. I apologize. Okay. Your Honor, I think I think the other question that you asked very briefly was that on the Fifth Amendment issue, I think one of you had asked about that, and the adverse inferences themselves are permissible. They're not mandatory, but it's not an abuse of discretion for Judge Hooks not to take an adverse inference here, particularly where the officers did all get up and testify. And then on the final point, Your Honor,
logical to say that it's a very rare case where an abuser or torturer admits to their conduct. Very, very rare. In fact, that's why they took the Fifth in cases after this. So why should we believe, the judge just hook, line, and sinker believe them? These are people that are known to have committed these acts and acts of alike to what we're talking about here. So, I mean, common sense has to have something to do with this.
Because I think what Judge Hooks did is I think he did a great job recognizing that his obligation was to decide the case that he had in front of him. It doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter. Of course, there are significant abhorrent acts that we're talking about. But Judge Hooks, who in many cases, many, many cases, has ruled in favor of the petitioners and in favor of defendants and found adversely and didn't believe the credibility of the testifying officers, did not have officers hiding behind the Fifth Amendment. They testified. Not only did they testify, George Anderson testified, and he had to assess their credibility. And before you can even get to any pattern evidence and any other acts evidence, you have to first decide what happened here. And he went through in painstaking detail using the Hobley lens, using the Patterson lens, of why these other bad acts that are alleged are or are not relevant here and whether they don't or don't carry the water. And I think that Judge Hook should be credited for that because it's obviously recognizes the historic context of this case, the remedial nature of the Turk proceeding. But despite that, he still made a very lengthy, detailed determination of what happened in the case in front of him. And I think that that is commendable, especially in the length of the opinion. That
my last question.
Sure.
Johnson, which came out before you filed your brief, which is in the reply brief, but not in your brief. Can you just tell us your reaction to that case?
Yes, and that's the second point that I was going to make other than the Rule 23 opinion. I agree with Your Honor, and I believe that Johnson did carve out somewhat of an exception to the notion that the voluntariness of a confession waives all non-jurisdictional defects. It's still relevant to certain post-conviction claims, but I think Turk is carved out from that. And to the extent we argue that in our brief, I withdraw that.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Judge.
Okay, Ms. Lovey.
Thank you. You know, we're all human, but we all have off days. I have nothing but respect for Judge Hooks, but his off day has cost Mr. Anderson life in prison without a hearing on some very serious and compelling torture claims. What we just heard from the state was counsel admitting to Judge Hooks's error, and that explains why we have a different of opinion on what the standard of review is. Counsel admits that what Judge Hooks did was basically conduct a suppression hearing. Do I believe this evidence? And that's why he's asking for a manifest way to the evidence standard of review. But that is not what the law says that he was required to do. And it's not just Wuerl. It's Wilson, this court, paragraph 52. It's Plummer, paragraph 98. And it derives from Patterson. What it says is when we're looking at these torture cases, it is actually a temporal question. Not what do I think, but what is, if there had been this evidence available at the time of the suppression hearing, what the outcome of that, would that outcome of that suppression hearing likely have been different if the officers who deny the harm had been subject to impeachment based on the pattern and practice evidence? Judge Hooks made a mistake. He instead conducted his own suppression hearing, skipped the law, and you can't change the rules like that and then change the standard of review based on the change of rules and then deny Mr. Anderson relief. What the law says is that that's the standard. Judge Hooks didn't do it, so therefore he never conducted this analysis. There's nothing for this court to actually defer to because he, as counsel admits, he never conducted the objective test. He only did the personal subjective test. And that's why this court has a de novo review. And when you take the test from the objective perspective, there can be no question that Mr. Anderson prevails. Now, I understand that Judge Hook's findings make it clear that he didn't believe Mr. Anderson or he didn't like Mr. Anderson or whatever. But the law is really clear that that does not even come into play until you get to the burden of persuasion. The first question is whether or not the state meets its burden of proof in light of the impeachment evidence. So when you do things in the proper order, you have the allegations of abuse, and then the next thing that happens is do the officers get impeached? And I'm quoting here from Galvin in paragraph 74, because I think it's really relevant. Galvin Court writes, the credibility findings made by the court against the defendant were not relevant to the issue of whether Detective Switsky's credibility at the suppression hearing might have been impeached as a result of the new evidence that Detective Switsky participated in systemic abuse under Patterson. So you don't even get there. And similarly, in Gibson at 120 and at Wuerl at 87, this court has looked at, well, what do you do if the defendant is a little bit, you know, has some differences because it's been decades and maybe he can be impeached on this or maybe we're not quite sure whether he's telling the truth on that. And the court time and time again says, the first thing you have to do is ask about this impeachment question. And that's what matters. And, you know, at the end of the day, the reason why they do this is because at the end of the day, even if some of the details are off, he can't remember whether it was, you know, who did what, who hit him, who punched him. The core allegations have been there since the 1990s, since the early 1990s. And as Judge Kuczynski pointed out, that's not a bandwagon at that point. You know, nobody knew about these things. They were so outrageous that nobody had heard of such a thing. And counsel tries to argue here that the original defense attorneys undermined these claims, and that is absolutely not true. These attorneys, both Judge Katz and Judge O'Hara, admit that back in the early 90s, these were the allegations that Mr. Anderson was being made. Now, whether or not everybody remembers exactly to what degree the medical stuff was brought up, or whether they made the connections, whether, you know, one of them is misremembering whether or not they made the connection between the surgery he needed on his left side and the torture that he endured, given that there was a time gap. You know, that's neither here nor there. The important things are that they substantiate the claims. The claims have been made since that early. And when you conduct the objective test, these officers would have been impeached.
Okay. Thank you very much, both of you, for your briefs and your arguments. We've been down this road before in other cases, and we'll go down the road again in this case. And we'll be back to you directly with our decision.